Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Okay, so hello everyone. This is Back in USSR, and I am Siegfried, and this is the first live show I think I've been doing since October. So this is, I once again apologize for that. I know I do this every time. There's been like a significant gap in just my output, but it's been a bumpy ride this past year. It's really been a bumpy ride. Not an easy time. Mental health has been a real issue for me as well. And there's been a lot on my plate, as there's been a lot on the plates of just about everybody who's going through the pandemic and all the other related things that are going on now. So it's been a while, but here we are. We're back in action. And I guess this show is kind of like a follow-up in a lot of ways to the episode I did in September 2021. Where I did an entire episode on violence against women. And this was in relation to the walkout, which happened at the University of Guelph. It happened, that was really based on what happened in London, Ontario, where I called it an atrocity back then. And it absolutely is. Like, I will still use that word, how bad it could get. I mean, I'm just going to give a content warning right here. Like, me and my guests, we're going to talk about some pretty heavy subjects. But we also want to drive home the point that people can take meaningful action and make real change. And we'll be discussing that too, with regard to things like sexual violence, violence against women. We can take concrete action to fight these things and to change people's attitudes, change policies, change society in the end. The structures that make this kind of violence possible, that facilitate it, we can challenge that. And ultimately, there's plenty of examples in history. We can ultimately take those things down and change them entirely. So I want to introduce my guest today. This is the first time I've done an interview actually in quite a while. But this is Jensen Williams, who is public educator from Guelph Women in Crisis. I know I got your title right.
You got it. Perfect.
That's great. And I'm really happy to have you on the show and to talk about these very important subjects. I know you do this all the time. I mean, this is your job, but I'm really glad that you took the time.
Thank you. Like you said, it is a job, but it's also a passion. So I'm always happy to sit down and talk about it. And I think both of us are on the same page that awareness is such an important piece of this and just needing to have more conversations about it. So I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, this is something that does not get talked about enough. It kind of, the media coverage of this subject, I'm sure you know exactly how it goes. Like, it kind of comes in waves, and you see the same thing with regard to systemic racism, which we saw with Black Lives Matter. You know, the struggles of indigenous people, it kind of, like, for a while you might get massive media coverage, such as when the struggles really peaked around Wet'suwet'en. Not that they ever ended, but then it kind of ebbs, even if the problem has not gone away, and it's not gone away, but it ebbs, and you don't see the same kind of attention being paid. So we had kind of a rise in attention in last September.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. And I'm sure you noticed that, like, there was like a lot of coverage in like the papers, Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, this sort of thing, in the media.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It definitely does come in waves, and I think it comes with shock value as well. And with any social issue, it's typically only reported on a large scale when something monumentally terrible happens, like the events at Western, like you mentioned, like the discovery of 215. These things tend to become a public conversation when something horrible happens. And unfortunately, you know, for those who are working in the gender-based violence field, for survivors, mm-hmm. for advocates, for allies, when we see this news come into the public eye, you know, we're not surprised, we're not shocked. But typically it comes with a feeling of both disappointment that, you know, we keep telling these stories, but we're not seeing a lot of action. But it also comes with, I would say the pandemic has increased the reporting around gender-based violence in a way that I haven't seen in a long time. And mm-hmm. so we do see, you know, an increase in these becoming more public conversations. But I think a lot of the time we need to, you know, recognize and raise that awareness, but also follow that up with meaningful action for sure. And I think that stands for not just gender-based violence, but a lot of different social issues as well, as you've mentioned, you know, indigenous mm-hmm. struggles, anti-racism, absolutely.
Yeah, 100%, right? Because the violence when it comes to systemic issues such as this, it is to a large extent normalized in the everyday manifestations of it. I mean, you get like any atrocity where I think it was like something like 30 women who got sexually assaulted at that party in London back in September. You know, they were drugged, sexually assaulted. And yeah, that is, you know, horrific, you know, when it happens on this mass scale, and that's going to make all the papers, that's going to get all this attention. But this is happening all the time, you know, this kind of, mm-hmm. you know, not at a mass level, but like, it's happening all the time. And mm-hmm. it does not enter the conversation when it's so pervasive. This is one of the things you mentioned a statistic, like a really horrible statistic, like, you know, 1 in 3 women can be expected to experience sexual violence in their lifetime. That's a really hard hitting figure. Right. But I think it's pretty hard for a lot of people to process that. And like, what does that actually look like? Right. Like, you see exactly. a figure like that, but it's like, what does that actually look like? How do you really process that? If you have anything to say on that.
Yeah, I mean, like, the statistics, I think they're out there, but the reality is like, I think to speak to the normalization is that they don't necessarily shock people in the way that they should. And I think it's because, you know, for female identified folks, even for trans folks, non-binary, and members of the 2SLGBTQ+ community, you know, experiencing violence, particularly related to their sexuality or gender, just becomes kind of an expected part of life. You know, women and girls and trans folks are even like socialized growing up to avoid sexual violence. You know, we're taught the messaging of, well, you know, make sure you don't accept a drink from anyone, or always go out with friends, or don't accept a ride home. So we're kind of socialized in this way that we're always living in fear of expecting sexual violence in some degree. And I think that, that normalization comes with the when it happens and when it continues to happen, we just see it as, oh, well, this is part of the world that we live in. You know, there's nothing we can do about it. And, you know, it speaks to the larger, like you said, this is a systemic issue that isn't just rooted in gender inequality. It's also rooted in racism, colonialism, many different intersecting forms of oppression that allows gender-based violence to continue. And so I think that, you know, the statistics are also, while we rely on them, very flawed, because we know that whether it's sexual violence, intimate partner violence, or even human trafficking, they're all underreported. Mm-hmm. And so the statistics are relying on formal reports, whether that be to, say, a post-secondary institution or for law enforcement. But there's so many barriers that when it comes to coming forward, you know, victim blaming is very pervasive. And so we see that while the statistics are telling us, you know, it is a huge problem, we know that it's even bigger than what the numbers are telling us. And so I always find that troubling as well, to actually, you know, have a scope of how many people are impacted by this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because this is one of the things that came up, I think, in the one of the workshops you ran last year that I attended. And it was, you know, really good workshop, by the way. I mean, like, I recommend, you know, the series of workshops Guelph Women in Crisis runs if you want to get this information and really, and, you know, we have like a chance to kind of get in depth, I think, with some more of these things here today. So much, right? Like, to try to, you know, explain these things. And if, like, people don't really have that much of a background in where they already know a lot of these issues or experience these issues for that matter.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people are often scared to ask questions. They're scared of not knowing things. And I personally have the best conversations with people who don't necessarily agree with me or don't necessarily share those ideas. And I think that that's another thing that we really need to just the importance of opening up these conversations is that it's also okay to not know and to ask questions and to seek out information. And just find those safe spaces, to find those workshops where you can be honest. And I think that's part of the work that we need to do as activists, as advocates, to help create that space where we're meeting people where they're at and we're helping to bring everyone along with this education.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's been really helpful for me. I mean, as a male identified person, right? I mean, this is not something I was brought up to know about. I was not educated on this. I mean, like, really the school system has a long way to go of, like, being able to really kind of bring this home to people and just how serious this is. And of course, like, the media, society in general, I mean, really having this explained and really, just bring that home. It's been such a journey for me as a male ally, as I would identify myself, really coming to understand this and really being sensitive to it and empathizing and this sort of thing. And it really is a long process. I mean, you're going to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. That is kind of like how, and you have to learn to listen. Mm-hmm. That is so huge. And you have to break through a lot of these assumptions, these kind of stereotypes, this kind of, you know, certain bigoted attitudes as well that are kind of like driven into us, like, from when we were quite young in this kind of society. And this goes with the same thing for, like, racism or, like, any of these other systemic issues that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all learned behavior.
Nothing automatic about it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I wanted to talk about the December vigil. This is on the 6th of December, and this was I think it was the first live event that Guelph Women in Crisis actually ran in, like, a few years, right?
Yeah, it was the first one we'd run throughout the course of the pandemic. So it was kind of despite the topic of us being joining together in community to talk about femicide, it was great to do that with the community. You know, it's been a tough year for women in crisis. It's been a tough year for survivors. It's been a tough year for everyone. So being able to do that live was definitely powerful. I think, you know, there is something about feeling, you know, your community around you, seeing your fellow advocates and allies. It's definitely an important part of the experience.
Yeah, it's huge, right? And of course, this is an annual event. This is on the anniversary of the École Polytechnique massacre, which was 1989. But I mean, there is, of course, a very good reason why we still mark that date. We still honor that. The victims of this, once again, a complete atrocity that took place at that time, right? And I want to get into, because this is the other thing that was driven home at that event, was just how much the pandemic has exacerbated violence against women. And I know you've touched on this a little bit already, but maybe just get into that a little deeper, what that looks like. Because even over the past year. I mean, I guess you did the vigil was online in 2020, right?
That's correct, yeah.
And then from then until December of just last year, I mean, things got noticeably worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'll be really interesting to see, you know, if we ever come to that time where we say, you know, it was post-pandemic, and to look at the research that comes out of examining the impacts of gender-based violence over the pandemic. But from what I can tell you of what things I'm looking at now, you know, there has been reports pointing to an increase in both frequency and severity of gender-based violence, particularly for those who are cohabitating, so living mm-hmm. in abusive situations, whether that be related to sexual exploitation or human trafficking, or related to intimate partner violence or sexual violence. And so why that is the case, or why, you know, we think as people who work in this field is, you know, the pandemic has really exacerbated what it means to be in crisis. And when there's additional stressors in the home, so, you know, we've seen so many job and income losses that can place a huge amount of stress on individuals and families. That can lead to, you know, increased substance use. It can lead to using unhealthy coping mechanisms, such as utilizing violence against, you know, your partner or your family. And as well, it's really increased the barriers for survivors to be able to access safe spaces and support services. So whether that be someone being able to, you know, go to a friend's house, whether that be a child who's living in an abusive home, being able to go to school to kind of mm-hmm. escape that situation. And even for those who, like I said, are maybe living in that situation that's abusive, having the privacy and the safety to make a crisis call or to attend, you know, a virtual appointment as opposed to going for an in-person appointment. Those are all things that got a lot more difficult because of the pandemic. And so we know that the violence is happening, but I would say, you know, our numbers, at least at Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis, aren't going up dramatically because we've seen, you know, there's increased barriers to be able to access support services. Many shelters, including our own, have had to operate at half capacity. And so the resources that are available to survivors have really had to shift and change. And many have been so flexible in being able to adapt to the pandemic. You know, we switched from in-person to online and had to almost immediately when it came to, say, counseling services. But it's been really difficult for survivors throughout the pandemic, and particularly when it comes to, I think, you know, that severity of violence. So December 6th, we chatted about how many women had lost their lives to femicide, so gender-based killings, in the last year, just in Ontario. And we had, I believe it was 53, you know, women and children who fell under that category. And in the previous years, it's been between, you know, 30 to 40. So pretty significant increase in, you know, seeing disproportionate impacts of violence continuing on, you know, Indigenous women and girls, racialized women and girls, members of the 2SLGBTQS community. And so it's been difficult to say. And I would say, you know, it'll be interesting to see what other research and reports come out to kind of analyze this, but also hopefully looking at, you know, preventative measures of if this continues and if this happens again at this scale, what are some, you know, emergency measures that can be put in place to help?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a really hard hitting event when I was attending that, and just going through the names and just who these people were. I mean, especially with the 13 victims of École Polytechnique, I mean, you actually have like some of their bios that you go through, just emphasizing that these are real people. Like they had hopes, they had dreams, they had like lives to live. They had so much more to give, and that was all taken away. And mm-hmm. and this, of course, is the case in every single femicide, though. Like all mm-hmm. these are not simply names. And that was the thing that was really so so important and also so like heavy about that event. Like just you realize that it's just is just driven home to you,
mm-hmm.
right? And just to understand that. So like that was such an important event. I really want to thank you once again for running that and playing such a pivotal role. You weren't alone, obviously, in facilitating that. But yeah, like that was still, I think that, I mean, that, I just was looking at that and like that must have taken quite a bit of courage to do that, right? Like you're getting out there and really kind of putting yourself out there and talking about this, such a profound, such a intense subject matter,
mm-hmm. right? No, thank you. I appreciate that. It's definitely, you know, it's not easy work, but I think it's important work. And the more people that we can bring along with us, the more hope that I have to see an end to this. And it was great, you know, to see 50 people, you know, still in the pandemic in a blizzard come out to join this was really, you know, it's always, I think that's the silver lining of it all is And I think that's why it's also powerful to do these things when we can in person, to be able to actually feel that community.
Yeah, the weather was not ideal that
evening. It's not on our side.
Which, yeah, like to some extent, that makes it even more powerful, right? Going back to the whole media attention thing, I mean, you did get some decent media coverage for that, if I recall. You did quite a few interviews, if I'm not mistaken, like around that time. So there was some decent
attention being paid. Yeah, it was great. We had some CBC National coverage, and then we had CTV News Kitchener. We had Ontarian at University of Guelph, right. Wellington Advertiser, Guelph Today. So it was nice to see kind of like both local and national coverage being paid. And of course, you know, on major stations each year, we're seeing some sort of reflection at least on in remembrance of L'École Polytechnique.
Mm-hmm. Well, like kind of in response to this, I mean, this kind of gets into how the criminal justice system kind of deals with survivors, right? Mm. And I just saw this just today. I mean, this report came out yesterday, and I just want to read this. This is probably a story that you know. So January 12th, 2022, in a partial victory with significant impacts for women facing male violence, Alberta grandmother, farmer, and abuse survivor Helen Nasland won her appeal today against a draconian 18-year sentence, but in a deeply disappointing result was resentenced to 9 years behind bars, less time served. And she, if I'm not mistaken, was in a situation where she had to defend her life mm-hmm. against an abusive partner, ended up basically using a gun and killing her abuser, longtime abuser, because right. the violence was getting life-threatening. And mm-hmm. she was charged with murder on that basis, like, you know, was not treated as self-defense. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to, like, if you had any sort of reaction to this, I mean, if you've been following this particular story, because this has been unfolding over several years now. Yeah, it's quite intense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it really, you know, it speaks to kind of, I guess, the lack of understanding of what the impacts of abuse on individuals, not just from the criminal justice system, but I think the public at large, particularly when it comes to, you know, I think that the broader idea of abuse is oftentimes our mind just goes to physical, especially when we're talking about intimate partner violence. But mm-hmm. what the courts are really slow and late coming around to is this idea of coercive control. So individuals having, you know, that repeated kind of emotional abuse that really deteriorates their self-worth, their self-esteem, their ability to, you know, make decisions, their confidence levels, and just overall the impact that has on individuals and how powerful that is. And individuals living in, you know, constant fear of their partner, what's next, what could happen. And in some cases, it can actually leave people feeling more fearful, say if they've left an abusive relationship, than if they're still in it, because at least there's some level of you can know what's going on because that person is close by. And so I think that you know, the case sort of speaks to the lack of knowledge about the impacts of trauma on individuals and how our brains react differently on trauma than they will, you know, in any other circumstance. And so I think that really needs to come around that broader understanding about the impacts of trauma and abuse on individuals. And, you know, we even see this oftentimes with even, say, police calls related to intimate partner violence. And, you know, anyone who had engaged in, say, like you're saying, self-defense could also end up in a situation where they're also being charged in that instance mm-hmm. related to intimate partner violence. And so it's a really double-edged sword when it comes to navigating, you know, say the justice system and having to justify your own actions as a survivor based on the abuse that you're experiencing can be extremely re-traumatizing and re-victimizing.
Yeah, like this is the barriers, right, that they're often faced by, you know, by survivors, by those who are experiencing intimate partner violence. Yeah, and this kind of gets to something I wanted to talk about, how state violence can intersect with intimate partner violence, because it wasn't me who experienced it, but of course I was kind of, I knew this person. I was in the same organization when this happened. It was a very, very difficult situation. I can only, like, as much as I tried to support the person in question, there was only so much that I could do. And this happened in 2012 at Oper Guelph. Obviously, I'm not going to name any names here, but the situation, the overall situation was frankly very scary at Oper Guelph in 2012. This is when Mandy Hiscox was actually in jail for conspiracy charges over the G20 protests back in 2010. This is, so there was already, there was already kind of like some dislocation in the organization because of that. And at that time, we actually were infiltrated. In this case, well, he was stupid enough to put his, his keychain on the table in front of me. When we met one time at Van Gogh's Ear, which back when that still existed. And it was kind of like an Oprah board of governors meeting, board of directors meeting, I guess is like, was the proper term. But I was on the board back then and I actually encountered this guy and he was, yeah, he had a CSIS keychain. You know, he obviously was part of this, he was part of this organization. He was completely undermining the organization from within, turning the staff against the board members against the staff, starting up like audit programs that was completely bankrupting the organization, making it so it couldn't do activism. And he was targeting certain female members of the staff, like who were opposing this process and harassing them and making it completely difficult for them to go about their daily work, all this sort of thing. The person he was targeting the most also was dealing with intimate partner violence at home. And in fact, ended up marrying their intimate partner because of to try to satisfy their immigration status. So all this stuff was going on at the same time. It was a really scary situation for a lot of people, but her in particular. And it was, yeah, it was a really seeing those two things kind of like intersect. Cause yes, there was also, even if it wasn't say sexual violence, this sort of thing in the workplace, you had violence in the workplace against this, this person. And you also had violence at home and there was like no escape. Like you could, someone like me who was their friend could try to do their best to support them, but there was only so much that I could do. And it was like a really, really scary situation. When you have those kind of two things coming in, like you have and they're all patriarchal, like in terms of the violence that was coming down, like from the state, because of that infiltration and from this person's partner at home. And so when those two things intersect, it's an absolute nightmare. And I don't know. And then you also come up with things like the story from the UK, several years ago, where you actually had undercover cops forming long-term relationships and fathering children with environmental activists. And basically where the whole relationship was basically a lie. You had like a undercover cop getting into a relationship with someone in one of these organizations and basically building a life with them, like even fathering children. And then it ultimately, you know, it turns out the whole thing was a lie to extract information from them and about their organization. Like this is some pretty heavy stuff. I don't know, like if you've followed any of this sort of thing, but it really is. Like, yeah, it's a facet of the kind of violence that that women do face, especially when they're in kind of activist circles.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with the environmentalist issue that you've brought up, and I can't speak to, you know, individuals and situations that I'm not aware of. I can speak kind of more generally to, I think, trends and what I'm seeing. And I think, you know, when it comes to organizations, you know, particularly say if you're mentioning, you know, activist organizations, just because a space is progressive and the ideas are progressive doesn't mean that everyone in it is, and everyone, that's a safe and inclusive space for everyone. You know, a feminist space can still be a homophobic or a racist space. And, you know, we oftentimes will see a lot of people excusing someone's abusive behavior because of their quote unquote, you know, good politics. And so I think it's interesting when we come of like, you know, social movements that are, you know, built upon community solidarity, we have to ask ourselves, well, what does accountability look like in a solidarity focused space? And you know that many like women leave organizations because of sexism and microaggressions not being taken seriously, you know, having their gender be kind of the main focal point of their identity. Even to look at, you know, for an example of looking at the ways in which, say, female identified politicians are reported about, you know, is it about their policies or is it more about their looks, the way they are as mothers, right, their dating lives and so forth. And, you know, to your point too about kind of people utilizing vulnerabilities to extract further violence, you know, individuals who have experienced past violence are more vulnerable to experiencing it in the future. And that goes for anyone. That can go for male identified folks as well. And because, you know, it is a cycle, right? It is, you know, you're taught kind of, you know, what you're not given the opportunity to know and feel what a healthy and good relationship looks like. And so that can lead to, you know, individuals also like abusing that trust, abusing that vulnerability. And so I think it really need to, any space has to have, you know, strong accountability politics. And we need to hold ourselves accountable and need to recognize, you know, just because someone is progressive or has quote unquote good politics doesn't mean that they're incapable of causing harm. Right. I don't think anyone is incapable of causing harm, right? We all have our faults. And I think it's about being transparent and honest about that and giving people, you know, the skills and tools, however we can, to be able to stop that before it starts. And that can look like having, you know, bystander intervention trainings, that can look like having consent-based trainings. It can look like a lot of different things. Even, you know, a lot of folks are having anti-racism, anti-oppression trainings. And that's all in that effort of being preventative, but also creating a space where you kind of set the tone to say, you know, by having this, we're all showing up for this work and we can hold ourselves accountable when we're not meeting the standard. So I think that all of those things are really important to really stop this before it happens, because we know that it's happening super often. And so not only do we need to have the things in place to be able to support survivors when that happens, but we also need to try to essentially stop it.
Yeah. Well, just as a footnote to that, that case about the infiltration of like environmental organizations in the UK, that actually was illegal at the time, but nobody did go to, nobody was punished for that crime, which had of course a devastating impact on these women's lives. I guess the kind of the footnote to that is the fact that the retroactively in a national security law that was passed, I believe just this past year, that was retroactively made legal. So actually in the UK right now, you can, if you're an undercover cop or if you're like an intelligence operative or something like that, you absolutely can go into a legally go into an activist organization. You can do whatever you want in order to further your goals. If that means like entering into a one of these fake relationships with somebody, you're making them, convincing them that it's the real thing, you actually love them, and you know, to the extent of even like getting married or fathering children, that's perfectly legal now, and that's quite a scary thing. Just making these kind of spaces safe when you're faced with these kind of things is very difficult. You know, it's something everybody has a role in, but in the end, like, we do have to have each other's backs as well. We have to protect each other, we have to look out for each other. And when it comes to activist organizations and where you absolutely can have this kind of violence perpetrated in those spaces by other activists. And this is something that has come up among communists, this has come up among socialists, progressives, in the environmental movement and like the anti-racism movement, all this sort of thing. You have a lot of male identified activists. It seems like almost when they join these groups, they just automatically assume, okay, I'm part of this organization, I'm doing the right thing. It's almost like a get out of jail free card almost, is they feel like this doesn't apply to me. Like I obviously must respect women, I'm part of this organization. But then in their actual, you know, with their partners, with some of their female friends, I mean, they can still engage in some of these toxic kind of behaviors and not even recognize it.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, you know, a lot of men will be like, oh, I'm a feminist, and then kind of like utilize that. I've even seen like on dating apps, people will have that like in their bio or something. And it's just like, it's always kind of a red flag. It's just like, tell me that with your actions. I don't need to always know, like, just from the label, because it's almost like in the same way of that like performative nature of, you know, just you're talking the talk, but you're not walking the walk. So you gotta have that too.
Yeah, because this actually had a major impact in terms of the collapse of the Ottawa Coalition Against Fascism back in 2019, where there was in fact like a case of intimate partner violence in that organization. I mean, of course, that was a coalition. There was multiple organizations that were part of this, but this was an organization that my friend who like lives in Gatineau, who was a part of, and he kind of saw this kind of unfold, like with this one person. I believe he actually even knew the person who engaged in this intimate partner violence. And then when he was called out for it, left the organization, but like then started posting all these toxic posts online, right? So kind of continued the harassment and acting like there was, like he did nothing wrong, didn't take responsibility for what he did, any of this sort of thing. you know, even though he was out of the organization, just how that undermined the trust within the organization, that actually played a major role in why the coalition ended up falling apart. Even after done some amazing work, especially in the wake of the 2019 federal election, where you had, you know, the PPC and like the rise of the far right and all this stuff. And like, you had a lot of like far right groups in all these different cities. And in Ottawa, like that coalition played a major role in like basically forcing the far right out, more or less. Like they actually were very successful in their actions, but in the end, they kind of were undone by certain toxic behaviors within their own ranks. And that's, I think, a lesson for like a lot of, like, basically anyone who's engaged in like activist work. You know, this is the kind of thing that, like, there are real consequences for this. If you say your organization is, you know, safe for women, you're defending the rights of women, you're providing them a safe space, and then you don't, you know, you allow these behaviors, like, even if you try to undo the damage after the fact, I mean, it might be too late.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, I think people feel as if when they're called out for something, and especially, you know, we've kind of seen this a lot with the unfolding of like the Me Too movement and just broader open public conversations that are holding people a lot of the times publicly accountable for the harms that they've committed against others in the context of the Me Too, against mostly women identified folks. And then it kind of creates this fear of almost like cancel culture of, oh, I'm going to be, you know, called out for something and men can't get away with anything anymore. And so I think it's, you know, it's interesting that, you know, that accountability is happening in a really public way. And I think that scares a lot of folks. But I also think it's like that accountability needs to also be followed up with like opportunities for education. You know, we don't need to just say like, hey, this behavior was wrong. It needs to be, and here's why, and here's the things that we can do, like you said, to correct that behavior. Things actually need to change. It can't just, you know, become unveiled because we know these things are happening. And we need to actually move forward with the action to be able to change that.
Mm-hmm. No, it's like absolutely just crucial, right? Absolutely central to the kind of work we need to be doing. Yeah, so those are both some pretty intense topics right there with the state violence and the violence against women in activist circles. But very important to understand. And this was another thing which kind of came up in some of the workshops that happened last year, like about how this idea of like those victims or those survivors who are considered worthy of attention, like, and this has a huge, this is hugely impacted by more systemic issues such as colonialism and racism, like, you know, who gets the media attention, like, if there is a case of, say, femicide, or there's a case of like, you know, domestic abuse or like this kind of violence, this sort of thing, who is listened to, right? Mm-hmm. And this is something that is very important to unpack.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, and I'm speaking to this not from lived experience of either experiences with colonization or racism. I'm mostly speaking from like academic knowledge. So I just want to be clear in terms of the framing of my positionality on that. But, you know, gender-based violence really didn't exist prior to colonization, at least in the Canadian context. You know, women and two-spirit and gender-diverse folks prior to colonization held a lot of social power, you know, a lot of matriarchal, actually, societies. And so we saw, you know, colonizers utilizing violence against women as a tool of colonization, you know, to devalue the status of women by, you know, conquering women to conquer their lands in turn. And in terms of that, you know, how that kind of legacy continues to play out is that, exactly like you said, certain individuals are seen as less valuable than others. And in this idea of, you know, survivorship and victims, we see, you know, this constructed narrative of like the ideal victim. And the ideal victim is typically someone, a woman who is white, able-bodied, probably middle class, someone who, you know, reports the violence, someone who, you know, doesn't do any like counterintuitive behaviors. And what I mean by that is, you know, say for, you know, sexual violence, if that person experienced sexual violence and continue to have contact with that person after, that would be seen as a counterintuitive behavior, because there's all these ideas of how survivors ought to act before, during, and after they experience violence. And so we've kind of created this narrative of who the ideal victim is, but the reality is that person does not exist. And it, we try to make it exist, you know, in the court system and particularly in the media. Even if you're looking at just a broad scope, it'd be really interesting, and I don't know if this exists, to see sort of a study of awareness ad campaigns around gender-based right. violence and what's portrayed in that type of imagery. You know, I know growing up and still to this day, I see a lot of, oh, it's a white woman with a black eye, someone with their hands tied up. And this sort of creates, I think, this savior complex as well of like, producing these images of like, these are the people that are worth saving. And it creates these really weird ideas about violence and survivors. But, you know, a lot of that is tied into to whiteness and white supremacy and certain individuals being, you know, more valuable than others. And we see this, you know, oftentimes with the reporting around, say, violence. I'll use an example of, say, human trafficking. And, you know, sometimes in the narrative and in the media stories, they'll focus on, say, the survivor's past history of sex work or addictions or struggles with mental health or poverty. And so they're focusing on these aspects of their identity rather than, you know, the wrongfulness of the actions and the violence that they experienced. Mm-hmm. And we don't see that in the same way as when it's reporting around people who fit more closely with this ideal victim narrative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know this with like missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls receive significantly less media attention than white and privileged missing women go murdered or are missing. And I utilize the example often of the Gabby Petito case, which was, you know, mm-hmm. the missing case of the United States. There's reports coming out that it seemed to be tied to some sort of intimate partner violence. And, you know, that case got such a shocking amount of international attention. And not that that person deserved that violence at all, and not that the reporting wasn't necessary and valued. It's just looking at it in comparison to the lack of reporting of when those of more marginalized identities experience similar levels of violence, it's reported in a very different way. And so that's why, you know, when it comes to, you know, feminism in general and our work to end gender-based violence, it has to be intersectional, and it has to be looking at the ways in which different people are impacted by this issue. Because it's not just women. Women aren't a monolithic population. You know, we have many different aspects of identity and experience. And so I think that that's, you know, a really important piece is that when we're doing this anti-gender-based violence work, we also have to be doing it alongside, you know, Indigenous solidarity work, anti-racism work. It's all connected. And we can't really play this oppression Olympics of valuing one more than the other, because we have to be working kind of alongside at the same time. Recognizing that, you know, that racism is fueling violence, that colonization is fueling violence, and the devaluation of not just women, but women of different identities and experiences. So, yeah, I think that's pretty much a summary of what I would say about that and the impacts. But I think also the importance of making sure when we're talking about these things that we're not leaving anyone out.
Yeah, that's crucial, right? And understanding these systemic issues, which of course, like, you know, they elevate certain groups and like keep others down. And of course, this is what, you know, absolutely deliberate in terms of the construction of the kind of systems that we're in right now. I mean, this was deliberately created, deliberately constructed this way, and it's going to take deliberate effort to change that. I mean, I just recall how, and this of course goes back into our discussion about state violence as well. Some of the recent resistance going on in the Wet'suwet'en territories, right, where you actually had you know, what's the armed RCMP coming in, you know, with their assault rifles, with all that stuff, and using like chainsaws to break into some of those tiny houses that were occupied by the matriarchs, right, of the Wet'suwet'en nation, right, and they were at the forefront of the resistance, and you see that kind of like violence coming down on them. Right. And just how blatant that was, and just how, you know, the government was trying to justify it and all this sort of thing. That really ties in with that. And of course, like, you also have just how these issues intersect. Right. This is like a major intersectionality. Like, this is such a major, a crucial thing to keep in mind when you have these discussions. Yeah. I remember like Guelph Women in Crisis, you had a presence there on, I'm still calling it Orange Shirt Day, but you know, it's at the end of September. And I was there, and I was really happy to see you there, actually, you know, like, and that was kind of a, just having that presence there and just having that, it was kind of intersectionality that was in practice, right, in action.
Mm-hmm. And that was really, that's so important to, you know, like, social movements and community work and grassroots organizations and organizing is that, we have to show up for one another, because we're not going to be able to do this work alone. And the more, you know, solidarity we have, not just with the work that we're doing, but with the work that other folks are doing, you know, and empowering each other. And I think, you know, on that allyship piece, it's like knowing what support we can provide and when to step up and step back. And I think, you know, just showing up is a great thing that folks can do, you know, just learning more, reading more about things. Like, it's a crucial step to understanding and to being able to show up when you can. And especially for those who have privilege, how can you utilize your privilege for good? How can you look at them back?
And crucial is the operative word here. Like, this is absolutely essential if we want to move things forward, if we want to move forward in this work, right? And speaking of that, I mean, we've kind of touched on how, the way I would describe it is that capitalism and economic austerity has kind of like exacerbated the violence against women in the pandemic, especially when it comes to like, because when it comes to like what is to be done to address things like violence against women, these kind of, which women in particular are dealing with during the pandemic. I mean, you spoke to that. I remember you spoke to that at the vigil on December 6th of last year. You mentioned some of these kind of policies like harm reduction, you know, mental health supports, affordable housing, youth programs, indigenous-led programs, really indigenous sovereignty, higher minimum wage, these kinds of things. That was really important, like you you saying that, like you getting into that and like the kinds of things that we need to do going forward.
Yeah, well, I think the solutions are like we need to look at the root causes of gender-based violence and addressing those. And, you know, sometimes when people think solutions, and I get why, their brains are like more funding for shelters, more funding for survivor support services. But the answers are like looking at actually investing in what are the root causes. You know, women make 60% of part-time workers and 70% of minimum wage earners. When we hear that narrative of, well, why don't they just leave? We're not talking about this, you know, the economic inequality or the gross lack of affordable housing, lack of affordable childcare. And so that question is, well, can I, why don't they just leave? It's can I afford to leave? You know, where will I live? Can I feed myself and my children? And so when we're looking at addressing effectively, you know, violence against women and girls, the answers have been given to us, I would say. You know, we have the calls to action from the National Inquiry into the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. Just in 2021, they released a national action plan on violence against women and gender-based violence. And so there's put a lot of, you know, funding and power into putting together, you know, kind of these roadmaps and these solutions. And so we also need to look at, you know, gendered impacts of policies, needing to implement pay equity, advocating for, you know, greater funding for social programs. And, you know, when we see with, you know, austerity measures, those are kind of the first things that are seen as to cut back is those social services programs. And recognizing that, you know, it's not just about achieving gender equality, it's about looking at how can we kind of eliminate oppression as a whole. And so I would say, you know, the solutions have been brought forward, many brought forward by those who are most impacted by this, survivors, Indigenous women and girls, advocates in the gender-based violence world, and an activist and allies. And I think that it's just a matter of listening and taking action and prioritizing this as an issue. And I think the first step before we get even into policy change is that I always say people change comes first. And so we need to actually shift our social attitudes and stop normalizing it, because I think that is probably one of the biggest problems is just, it's just seen as, you know, it's just the world we live in, you know, women will continue to experience violence. And I think we actually just have to say, well, why do we think that we can't do something about this? And it starts, I think the biggest change that can start with everyday conversations, you know, when you hear someone who's saying something that is harmful, and that can be harmful in a gender related sense, it can be sexist, it can be oppressive in any sense, you know, interrupting that behavior, taking that opportunity to call someone in and tell them why it's wrong. And I think that that in every step of the way can just help to build more people who are saying, you know, this isn't okay. Because when we don't say that, it allows it to keep going and keep manifesting. And so we need as many people as possible to just in their everyday lives and conversations, take a stand however they can, whether that's in their workplace, in an activist organization that they're part of, making sure that this is a priority and you're not just saying it, but you're actually doing it too.
Yeah. Especially when you're up against something that's been normalized to this extent, right? I mean, this is like something you have to consciously kind of come to grips with in your own life. You know, very crucial. I mean, especially if you're a male identified person, right? I mean, this is something you actually do have to come to grips with. You have to work on. And like I said before, with when it comes to male allyship, is you have to listen, you have to be empathetic, you have to really do the work, right? Don't just assume, right? Based on, I don't know, what politics you identify with or whatever, or if you're part of a certain organization that you have arrived, that now you don't have to worry about this. It's like, you will have to worry about this. This is crucial. Like in all these situations, just same with racism. Like, don't assume that you're an anti, you know, because you engage in, like, say, an anti-racism work, that you can't be racist in certain situations, right? You know, or be sexist in certain situations, or like engage in toxic behaviors in certain situations, you know, with certain people. This is something, you know, it's like you just so often fall back on those kind of behaviors. Like, even when they think, right, that they've gotten past that, or they've overcome that, or that no longer is a part of their lives. It's when things are structural like that, you know, that's definitely something to keep in mind, right? That this is a really conscious effort that has to be made and sustained over time. And that's why it has to be part of a community effort, really. Like, people, they shouldn't have to do this stuff alone. It's really hard to do this stuff alone. And really, it's almost impossible to do this stuff alone. Mm-hmm. Like, it kind of comes into the whole idea of, like, I don't know, decolonizing yourself. It can't be done. Like, when it's a systemic issue, you can't actually decolonize yourself. It's not an individual thing. It's a systemic thing. And you have to approach it on a systemic level, right? And there's all this stuff you can do, but in the end, if that system's still in place, you're not free of colonialism, right? And I think the same could be said for sexism. The same could be said for racism, all this kind of stuff that we face, that we fight against. Now, one of the things which I, because it is important to look at alternatives, or what can be done. And I did, you know, this might seem like a very foreign concept here in Canada, but the example that I gave in the show I did back in September was the example of the Federation of Cuban Women, which is a very impressive organization. It operates on a national scale. It is part of it's a public organization. It's basically part of the government. It has a guaranteed block of seats in the National Assembly. It has committees in every neighborhood, you know, places where if people are actually experiencing gender-based violence, they can go to them. You know, they have the power to intervene. They have the power to combat, to take proactive measures to combat, you know, sexist views, sexist behaviors in the workplace, in unions, in like day-to-day lives, in the education system. And this is what mobilization, organization really can kind of, it can lead to, right? That level of where it's like, okay, you can actually combat it on a national scale, and you can get serious about this. And it's not all downloaded on the individual, right? Mm-hmm. And the individuals who do this work, they're all together, right? They're all together. They actually have political power. They have influence, and they're able to use that influence for, you know, to tear down those systems of patriarchy that, like, if, well, in the case of Cuba, we're like embedded there by colonialism, same as here. And which I'm sure a lot of people thought could never be taken down, but they're in the process of being dismantled. And like, just the victories that can be won, it's amazing what can be done. And I think that's really important to remember, because it's really easy to get to be down about these things, right? To really assume that it's just so huge, so deeply embedded that it can't be meaningfully changed, right? And that's not the case.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, as someone who's doing this work all the time, I can definitely feel that way too, of just like, oh, and the news articles continue to come out. And it's just, it can be really draining, of just like, you know, things are happening, things are changing. But at the same time, sometimes we feel like we're almost going backwards sometimes. And so I think that's why I love, you know, the community-based work, because I think for anyone who's looking to get involved, know that this change isn't going to happen overnight, and start with small victories. You know, start with maybe you're in your organization and you just want to start with, pick a couple things, pick two things. Maybe it's a policy, maybe it's an event you want to run, and know that each time you're doing that, you're engaging someone else in a new way. And so any conversation that you have, like, I think it's about defining like a victory as well, right? Because it can be difficult to see those things when you're, you know, maybe a smaller like grassroots or nonprofit, and looking kind of at the big picture of things and celebrating that. And I think taking a moment, there's not a lot of time or opportunities for joy or celebration in this work or in this movement or and in a lot of social movements. So I think it is important to to start small, to find your allies, to find your community, and know that, you know, I think that's really important, is not working alone, and finding other people who are on the same wavelength as you, who can help and be your champions in this, and think about, setting goals, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year, kind of look at some things. And when you look back at that, you'll know, if you're doing the work, that you have created some change. And even if that change is internal, even if that's reflective, just your own learning, you know, that's a victory in and of itself. And so I think for those who are, you know, looking to make that change, are kind of overwhelmed by it, a great place to start is just to recognize, you know, acknowledge that this is happening. Find out what organizations or groups in your community might already be doing this. Seek to align yourselves with them. I think that's a really key way, is that, you know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. Find some other people that might be able to support you in this. And that can start by just, you know, going to an event. Like you said, you know, you showed up at December 6th at the vigil. You can volunteer. You can even sharing, you know, social media posts. Like, it all adds up. It all goes a long way. And so I would say, you know, no victory is insignificant. And it just starts with, I think, just trying and, you know, doing the work and making the effort. And yeah.
Yeah. This is something that has to be built up over time, right? Mm-hmm. There are no easy victories. And yeah, this is another thing I said in the show last September. It's like, what is needed is, you know, deeply felt this. I deeply felt this as part of the, you know, the activism that was going on at the time. What is needed is community, communication, accountability, justice, respect, consent, and love. Those are the kind of like things which I got out of that. That was, you know, the kind of what it came down to, I guess. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like, I really appreciate you you coming on here today and taking this time to talk about these absolutely crucial, you know, crucial subjects, crucial issues that we are indeed facing and that we have to continue to face, well, together, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. I very much appreciate that. Thank you, Jensen.
Anytime.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop right on. What's
up? Hey, man, what's your name?
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Hey, Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today.
Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Oh, what's going on? Don't punish me with brutality.
brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on.